29.
Oh, that's a little sheet, please.
Yes, thanks. Anyway, as I was saying, the liberals are very subjective in their argumentation, so there's nothing really substantive in what they have to say against Ezekiel being the author. And again, it's my personal opinion that they're motivated by their assumptions. It's kind of like what, maybe it was Lanny talking about in his camp meeting sermon, that logic will lead you to the truth only when your assumptions that you're building your logic upon are correct, and it'll be as your conclusions are going to be as correct as the assumptions that you start with. So, and of course, Ezekiel abounds with the supernatural element of the Bible. They're filled with visions and the cherubim and end time prophecies, Battle of Armageddon and the temple and so forth. And I can see why they've done a real hatchet job on it as a result. And therefore, their mixed up reasoning is really not worth examining in this course with our relatively limited amount of time. So I'm not even going to bother going through even one of them. However, I would refer you to some of the better conservative commentaries on the book of Ezekiel. Converted Jew Charles Feinberg, Feinberg, wrote one. The old Lutheran German theologian of the last century, Ernst W. Hengstenberg, wrote a detailed commentary on Ezekiel. John B. Taylor wrote a recent one for InterVarsity Press, a thin volume. Those are three that come to mind. Of course, Carlin Delitzsch, they're always fairly trustworthy. Lang's, I don't know who did the one for Lang's, but anyway, there are a number of them, and if you were interested, and even some of the better Bible dictionaries on the subject, in finding out some of the arguments and the rebuttals to them, then I would just refer you to those and other commentaries. But I will suffice with quoting the words of Merrill F. Unger, a conservative evangelical scholar who authored a commentary on Zechariah. Don't believe he did one on Ezekiel. And, of course, Unger's Bible Dictionary and various other works, degree in archaeology. One of the men from Dallas Theological Seminary says, quote, "The story of negative criticism is the same. It begins in doubt and ends in utter confusion and uncertainty, demonstrated by the varied and contradictory views of recent scholars," end quote. And in other words, they can contradict themselves. And if they were, how can they all be right when they're giving opposing and contradictory views? I mean, all of these opposing views can't all be right. Specifically, John B. Taylor's commentary gives six reasons in his introduction of the book as to why he feels that Ezekiel is the author. So that might be one to point you to. All right, date of the book or of the man's ministry. We're going to go by the dates 593 to 560 BC, of course, for the ministry of the prophet Ezekiel. Now, this means that he ministered about, 33 years, approximately. And he was possibly 30 years old when he began his ministry in 593 BC. So if he was 30 years old when he began it, and he ministered for about 33 years, then that means at the end of his ministry he was some 63 years old. Now, the chronologically latest message of Ezekiel's that is precisely dated in the book, actually only carries us down as far as 570 BC. So if you wanted to get technical, you could say that we can, as far as hardcore evidence, we only have evidence for 593 to 570, as far as his last date of prophecy goes. But I take it down to 560. I believe he did minister for another 10 years. That prophecy, by the way, is chapter 29, verse 17. That's the latest dated message of Ezekiel 29:17. So it's possible that he didn't minister much past 570, in which case he ministered only 23 years, not 33. He ministered to the age of 53 instead of 63. But I believe that it's quite possible that he lived to 570 B.C., which is a date of some significance, because one of the kings of Judah that was taken into captivity, in the very captivity that Ezekiel was taken in with, which was the king Jehoiachin. Now, if you took Jeremiah, you remember some of these fellows maybe. C-H-I-N as in Nancy. Jehoiachin. He was taken into captivity in 597, I believe it is. And this man was put in prison in Babylon for many, many years. And then all of a sudden, a new king... I don't know if it was Merodach Baladan or who it was, but a new king arose in Babylon, and he let the man out of prison after being in there, 30-some years or something, 570 B.C., 20-some years, I guess. And I believe that it's possible then that Ezekiel lived to see this man let out of prison in 560. Well, let's see. Let out of prison in 570, yes, and then lived later than that in order to be able to record it in the book of Ezekiel. So therefore, that's why I am going by, and we're going to be using in this class, the 593 to 560 dates, a 33-year ministry. Now, purpose, message, and theme of the book. First of all, with regard to the Babylonian captivity, Ezekiel is pointing out that God is very justified in bringing... his people into captivity. And the justification for that is the fact that the people had apostatized. That is the form of the word apostasy, apostatized. They'd fallen away from the faith. And second of all, in regards to the Babylonian captivity, that was the very last resort on God's list, checklist of things that he could do with the people. You know, he was down to the bottom of the stack, and that's all that he had left. And he did it as a last resort in order to keep the entire nation from losing out with God. And of course, we know for another reason as well, tracing the scarlet thread of messianic prophecy from Genesis to Revelation, we can say furthermore, because he wanted that godly seed to be preserved so the Messiah could be born to die for the sins of the world. So certainly God had a vested interest in the continuance of this nation. And then third of all, that it would be God's judgments that would cause Israel to know that he was God. It would be his judgments that would cause them to know. See, now, it didn't have to be that way. It didn't have to be. You know, God forbid that we ever think that it has to be God's judgments coming upon us vis-a-vis Sunday night camp meeting sermon with Barbara Barnett's revelation concerning a certain individual and then the sobering sermon that follows. God forbid that we ever have the mentality to think that that's what it has to be before we realize he's got a crown and a scepter. The Bible tells us that. We should know he's king and lord and sovereign, and we should live in accordance with that knowledge instead of waiting till he has to use that sovereignty and rulership over us in a negative manner before we finally snap to. Second of all, with regards to the end of time, the purpose, message of the book is that the glory of the Lord had departed from his people. And Ezekiel sees this, by the way, in a vision. He actually sees the glory of the Lord leaving the temple in Jerusalem. It's a terrifying scene because of the ramifications of it. But that glory of the Lord would return to his people one day and would reestablish them as the people of God. How many moves of God in past church history have had the glory of God depart? And now they are dead, absolutely petrified, spiritually speaking. But the glory of the Lord will return. That is, God loves those people. He loves them. While we were yet sinners, God commends his love towards us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. So why should he love church people any less than he loves sinners? They're sinners too. Some of them not even born again yet. And God's glory is going to return. It's going to return to his people and establish them. That is, those who will, of course, yield to him. And second, that God would judge Israel's enemies. And that was a question in their mind. Well, what about Babylon? Of course, people that are under the judgment of God sometimes become defensive and want to point the finger. Well, what about them? God will take care of them. What about these demons? God will take care of the demons. What about the devil? God will take care of the devil. What about that other person, Lord? God will take care of that other person. And he certainly took care of Babylon, didn't he? In other words, Babylon was not justified in taking Judah captive just because the Lord allowed it and indeed used it to chasten his own people. They were not justified in doing what they did, particularly to the extent to which they did it. They went beyond a certain limitation, you might say, that God had given them. And for those two reasons, they were to be judged. And, of course, God raised up the Medo-Persians to do that. Now, there are some keys in certain phrases that are repeated several times throughout the book of Ezekiel. One of those is, the word of the Lord came to me. The word of the Lord came unto me. Obviously, that often denotes the beginning of a prophecy and or prophetic vision. That's somewhat reminiscent of the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, where it says the word of the Lord came into him and spoke to him and told him, you know, when he was still in the womb, that God had foreknown him and ordained him to be a prophet to the nations and so forth. 49 times this phrase is used in the book. I desire myself and all of us to be in a place where we are. Remember how Paul told Timothy, if a man therefore purge himself of these negative things, he'll be a vessel prepared, meet for the master's use. I want us to be in a place where the Lord, where we are worthy vessels, and not worthy in ourselves, but worthy as vessels, that the word of the Lord can come to us. I want God to be giving us things, positive things, blessings for ourselves and for others. You know, his love and his life and his truth. We need to be in that place. God couldn't raise up just anybody for an Ezekiel, you know. He took a special man, just like the Apostle Paul. After his conversion there in Acts chapter 9 and verse 15, he tells Ananias, who's paranoid about even ministering to the man, he says, go your way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me, and he will bear my name before kings and before Gentiles and before the children of Israel. God had that man's life prepared from the very beginning as well. And here was a man who was used of the devil. You better believe the devil. Demons of murder, hate, persecution, envy, jealousy, rage, violence were raging in the man. For him to be in a state where he's watching Christians with the love of God all over their faces, praising Jesus with glory of God all over them, being stoned to death, watching their faces turn into a bloody, unrecognizable mass. What kind of a person could do that? Only one that is driven to a certain state by demons. That man became the Apostle Paul. A chosen vessel of God. Now, how can we stand here and limit God? If he could do that, we cannot limit God. So we must make a distinction between God preparing a person by his foreknowledge and saying, well, we must be thus and we must be such before the Lord can use us. I mean, I'm not proud of me. If you knew my background, if you knew my set of demons, if you know, not mine, but if you knew my problems and so forth, we're all cut out of the same cloth, brothers and sisters. We are clay of the earth. We are of the earth, earthy. But the Lord is changing us from glory to glory into his image and likeness. And God has mighty ministries for his people in the end time. You're going to see prophets raised up again. You're going to see men of God with unbelievable power of God and knowledge of God and love of God flowing out and miracles that are going to be performed because he loves his people. And that's going to have to happen if God's word is ever going to go out, if he's ever going to accomplish what he's prophesied in the word of God. It has to happen. It has to happen. Somebody's going to do it. But we need to be part of that people. So Ezekiel certainly had something to do with the fact that God chose him. We won't get into all of it right now, maybe, but we're going to see in a minute that he was a priest. And it means his father was a priest. His father was a priest before him and so forth. It was by hereditary succession, sons of Aaron. And it's very possible, probable, that he had godly parents that raised him to hate sin and to love righteousness and knew the word of God and preparing to minister as a priest, even though he never did actually do so in Jerusalem, being carried away. So he had something that the Lord could use, didn't he? He had something, meager though it might be. Anything we have is meager compared to the Lord. Anything we would have to give to him, I don't care how great your talents are, it's meager, it's small. But if we'll give it to the Lord, he can use us, and he will use us. So the word of the Lord came to him. 49 times that's mentioned in the book. Also, the phrase, the glory of God, is found 12 times in the first 11 chapters of the book. And so the book is filled with the glory of God. My, we could sure use a truckload or two of that, couldn't we? The glory of God. And then third of all, the phrase, they shall know that I am God. They shall know that I am God. In other words, that Yahweh is God. Not these other gods, not anything else, but that He is God. We see this phrase 30 times from chapter 6, verse 7, through chapter 39 and verse 28. From 6, 7 to 39, 28, we see it found 30 times. And actually, in the whole book, it's used well over 60 times. So it's another very key phrase. They shall know that I am God. In other words, He's going to do something. He's going to do whatever is necessary for people to acknowledge Him for who He is. My, isn't that parallel to the situation today? How many people really know? I mean, even people that know the revelation, the unfolding revelation of God, really know Him. Because we're going beyond that now. We're going beyond theological knowledge. We're talking about experiential knowledge, that have a life in the Spirit with Him, that know Him as He is, have seen Him in a sense, you know, as He is, have experienced Him, are experiencing Him, are becoming like Him. And God is going to do whatever is necessary to give His people the opportunity to know who He really is. That's because He loves them. It'll be an awesome thing. It'll be a fearsome thing in a sense, but it'll be a purifying thing. It'll be a cleansing thing. It'll be just what His people need. Now, what about the prophet himself? As I have already indicated, he was of priestly descent, just like the prophet Jeremiah, who was a contemporary, as you will see when you buy the chart and look at it. And in the meantime, take my word for it. If I remember right, Jeremiah's ministry was about 627 to 570 B.C. So you can see the overlap there, 627 to 570 B.C. Now, and he was also a priest and prophet like Zechariah, the minor prophet. Now, he wouldn't come for a number of years till after Judah was returned to the land. The Jews returned to the land after exile. God raised up Zechariah. But both, all three of these were prophets and priests. Jeremiah, Zechariah, and Ezekiel. We see from chapter 1, verse 3, he's called Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi. Now, absolutely nothing is known of his parentage. That is, of his parents. We know of his parentage. His father was Buzi, and that's where the information ends. Don't know anything about him. Now, Freeman, in his book, Introduction to the Prophets, has conjectured that Jeremiah was from the line of Ithamar, son of Aaron, and that Ezekiel was of the line of Zadok, which is from the other son of Aaron, Eleazar. Remember, Aaron had four sons, taking you back to the book of Leviticus now, and he had Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And on the very day that the tabernacle was anointed and inaugurated, and the priests offered sacrifices before the Lord after they had been given their garments and anointed by Moses, because somebody had to anoint the priests, you know, and so he was the mediator, and they were offering sacrifices, Nadab and Abihu came out and offered quote-unquote strange fire before the Lord, and a fire came out from the Lord and destroyed his eldest two sons on the very first day of their ministry. I mean, talk about an awesome experience. That's their counterpart to the Ananias and Sapphira syndrome. Well, he had two left, Eleazar and Ithamar. And so all the priests that would follow from that time and on would have to be descended from Aaron through one of those two sons. It's like everybody goes back to Noah through Ham, Shem, or Japheth. Well, all the priests go back to Aaron through either Eleazar and Ithamar, unless, of course, Nadab and Abihu had sons that survived them, and I don't know on that situation. But in any case, the speculation is that Jeremiah came from the line of Ithamar, I-T-H-A-M-A-R, and that Ezekiel came from Zadok, who was a good man of God, a righteous priest, who was given a very special promise that those that are of his lineage shall minister as priests before the Lord in the millennium. The Zadokite priest, Don's preached on it before. And Zadok was from then Eleazar, the other son of Aaron, E-L-E-A-Z-A-R. But we can't be sure about that. Now, Ezekiel went into captivity in 597 B.C., You've got three major events here as far as being carried into captivity: 605, 597, and 586 B.C. In 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came against Judah and during the reign of King Jehoiakim, K-I-M, and he took the vessels from God's temple and a certain spoil, plunder, and he took several selected young men in order to train them in his court to be administrators in his kingdom, among whom was Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, Belteshazzar. And so this was 605 B.C., when Daniel goes into captivity and stays there throughout the whole 70-year captivity. And then after the Medo-Persians defeat the Babylonians, he ministers under Medo-Persian kings for a while. Then in 597, this is during the reign of Jehoiakim, the Chin ending, C-H-I-N, who was the son of Jehoiakim, who after Jehoiakim, after having reigned only 3 months and 10 days, Nebuchadnezzar came again against the Jews because of revolting against his sovereignty. He was over the nation of Judah at this time. And this time there was a big carrying away. Some 18,000 people, if I remember right, and they were the cream of the crop. He took the most skilled, the professionals, the artisans, the craftsmen, and the leaders, for a number of reasons, two at least. Number one, he wanted them in his kingdom to build his kingdom. And number two, with those people gone, it was a lot less likely, without the cream of the crop, the leaders there, that they would be able to foment another rebellion against his kingdom that he'd have to go through the hassle of going over there and putting down. So this is when Ezekiel went. My guess is he was 25 years old when he went into captivity, and after 5 years living in this refugee camp on the River Kibar, the heavens were opened, as we're going to see in chapter 1, and God gave him visions and anointed him as a prophet, sovereign anointing of God. And he stays there most likely throughout the remainder of the Babylonian captivity, although we can't say that for sure because that doesn't end until 536. B.C., and the last we see of him is for sure is 570 and possibly 560, so we don't really know what happened to him after that. All right, 586 B.C., in the 11th year of the reign of the king Zedekiah, they revolted again against Babylon's supremacy. They went down to Egypt to get alliance with them and other nations to try to throw off the yoke of Babylon against the prophecies of Jeremiah and others. And he came down and he was upset this time. Nebuchadnezzar said, "This is it. I've had it with these rebellious Jews. They're going to pay now." And so he destroyed the city of Jerusalem. He breached the walls. He burned the houses. He threw everything down. Thousands of people were killed in the slaughter. And he deported all but a very small handful of the very poorest of the land back into Babylon to join the ones that had gone in the previous two captivities. Of course, 605, not that many went. But 597, you've got 18,000 or so. Now, thousands and thousands more are going into captivity. And that's the fall of Judah. That's it. And they're going to be in there till 536 B.C. And so the Babylonian captivity is marked from 605 to 536 B.C. That's your 70 years. But it was actually only 50 years from the time of the last deportation until the Jews under Zerubbabel, I guess, was the first governor to lead them in there, came back to the land. But 70 years of total from the very first carrying away there. Now, so when Ezekiel went into captivity, Jerusalem was still Judah was still a nation. Even though they were under the yoke of Babylon, there were still thousands of people living in the land. They still had a king. They had the temple worship and so forth. But now the nation was kind of divided. You had a group of exiles here in Babylon, and you had the rest of them over there in Judah. And it would be another 11 years, from 597 to 586, until the land was destroyed. But in the meantime, after 5 years of that period is up, so there's another 6 years then left before they fall, that God raises up Ezekiel to be a prophet and to prophesy concerning what's going to happen to that group in Judah, and what's going to happen to the group in Babylon, and of course all the way up to the end of time, and various nations, very broad prophetic ministry. Now, if he went into captivity at the age of 25, and you're going to see when we get into chapter 1 why I'm speculating that he was 30 when his ministry began, and therefore 25 when he went into captivity. If so, that would be the age when his priestly training would have begun. Because according to Leviticus, they were, most likely this is the way it was, there was a 5-year apprenticeship period from 25 to 30, and then at 30 they actually could go in the temple and minister as a priest. Well, that might have been somewhat disappointing for a man who's waited, a quarter of a century, 25 years, to be put into the priestly ministry, and then right when he would have gone in, boom, find himself in captivity in a foreign land, away from family, friends, and so forth, wondering now what. You know, our lives take some turns sometime that we would never suspect that they would take. How about Moses? He knew God was going to use him to deliver Israel. So he ups and kills an Egyptian, finds himself hours later having to flee for his very life from Egypt, and for 40 years he's living in a nothing burger town in the desert. I mean, he was worse than Tukwila. I mean, Tukwila is a major metropolitan area compared to what Moses had to contend with, the bleating of sheep for 4 decades. I mean, that had to be discouraging in the natural. The story of Joseph. How many more could we bring up from the Bible where it looked like God said, you're going to be way up here, and they find themselves after that way down there? Call it demons or retaliation or whatever you want, but the fact is they weren't quite ready for that ministry yet. Just because God prophesied of it didn't mean they were ready for it. He did that to encourage them. Indeed, had he not given it, could they have ever even made it through those valleys? And to the other hand, one might wonder. So Moses went through it, John the Baptist went through it, Paul went through it, Ezekiel went through it, Joseph went through it, we're going through it. Here we have these mighty, grand, and lofty prophecies, man, child, ministry, the world is going to shake, and so forth, fall at your feet like a ripe fig into your hand. Here we are still battling. You demon of fear, I rebuke you in the name of... You know, what's happening? We're not ready for it. That's what's happening. The Lord is preparing, whether we think we're ready for it or not. We're not ready for it. And they're not ready for it. And the Lord isn't ready to give it yet either. And so in the meantime, it's another lap around Mount Sinai, or two, or three, a la Steve Barta, if that's what it takes. Maybe I should have Steve with his guitar up here and sing it right at this time. Don't feel less, okay. Be hard without the guitar anyway. Until we are ready for the ministry. Besides that, God had a different ministry for Ezekiel than what he... What would he do? Go into that temple where they had idolatry and all... In fact, God was going to show... I'm stealing a little thunder here, but that's all right. There'll be enough thunder for that day. Sufficient is the thunder for the day thereof. Jesus said something like that, I think. But God was going to show Ezekiel in a prophetic vision. He was going to take him, transport him in the spirit, you might say, all the way back to that temple in Jerusalem that maybe he, from a lad on upward, was just yearning to be able to minister before the Lord in. And he was going to show him unspeakable sin being committed in that very temple. And so what good would it have done for him to be able... He'd been like Lot in Sodom, vexing his righteous soul day by day. He might have been affected by it. He might have fallen into himself. I mean, we don't really know. And so much better to be with the exiles in captivity and minister a message of warning, hope, warning, judgment, and also hope that there would be a reconciliation, that they would come back. And the tremendous end-time prophecies that he had. So sometimes we think we know what God's got in store for us when God has something different and, yea, far better for us. Far better for us in this life and in the life to come. As far as rewards and even making it goes. Now, in captivity for 5 years, who knows what he did during that time? Did what any other Jew did during that time? I don't know if there was slave labor in that particular camp or if they were granted. They did have some freedom. We'll see some indications of that in the book. We do see a little glimpse of their life there. Not much, but in any case, he just was there for 5 years. And then at the age of 30, which, again, is the age when he would have begun his priestly ministry. After 5 years among the Babylonian exiles, out there in nothing land, God anointed him to be a prophet. And, of course, 30 speaks of the age of maturity. So the truth that we draw from that is that when we're mature, now, I don't know how old that's going to be for some of us or how long, much training that is, whether it's 20, 30, or 40, the fact remains, when we're ready, when we can handle it, and, of course, you're never as ready as you really would want to be. I mean, it's funny how we are. Sometimes we think we're more ready than we are. We think we're ready to go when we're not ready to go. Then other times, maybe when we actually go, we realize we're not as ready as we thought we were. In fact, we're not even ready enough to go, we think. But you're never going to be perfect before you're put out there. You're going to be out there. You're going to be adequate. God will give you what you need. You'll be mature enough to have the yoke of the ministry upon your shoulders. So, at the age of maturity, God will put us into the ministry. Count us worthy to minister for him. And so he was counted worthy to minister as a prophet, living either at or near a place called Tel Aviv. Now, don't confuse this with the current city of Tel Aviv in Israel, but this is Tel Aviv. T-E-L-A-V-I-B. This was a refugee camp, a little city set up there. Located about 40 miles east of Babylon, Okay, we have a map here. Let's take a look-see. Well, looking at our map, he was taken out of Judah, maybe followed the travel trade routes along the Fertile Crescent, came down here. Now, here's the city of Babylon itself. So this map is not the right scale to perhaps to even see it if they were to even have it on here. But about 40 miles east of Babylon, this city of Tel Aviv, that he lived either at or near. It's not real clear. Now, this was located on the River Chebar. C-H-E-B-A-R. It's called a river. It was actually a large canal in the Euphrates River irrigation system. They would build canals off these rivers in order to irrigate the land. And we see the elders of Israel at one point in time, for example, coming to Ezekiel's house for instruction. So they knew where he lived. He lived at a certain spot. So that means they must have had a somewhat settled existence. Once they got there, they could live in a home and so forth. With this, you can put chapter 1, verse 1, where he says, I was among the captives by the river Chebar. And then in chapter 3, verse 15, he says that he came to the captives at Tel Aviv, and he sat there for 7 days. Now, that would seem to indicate that he was not right in the town proper, where the major concentration of people were, but he was near it enough to be able to walk to it and be there. And then in chapter 8, verse 1, we see him sitting in his house. Chapter 8, verse 1. Now, Ezekiel had a wife. We don't know anything about her except that the very day that the final siege against Jerusalem began. Now, it lasted about a year and a half. So it started about 588 B.C. and somewhere in that year, and then lasted till about 586. The very day that the siege began against Jerusalem, his wife died. Chapter 24, verse 18. And she died as a sign because she represented the nation of Judah, and the nation of Judah was dead. All right, Ezekiel was a contemporary then, as I've said, of Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, who was ministering in Jerusalem, who began his ministry in 627 B.C. as a young man, very young man. So young he felt totally unequipped to begin the ministry. Now, Ezekiel, if Jeremiah began his ministry in 627, and Ezekiel isn't deported until 597, that means that he got to see Jeremiah minister for three-quarters of his ministry. 30 of the 40 years of Jeremiah's ministry was observed by Ezekiel, if he lived in Jerusalem or even near it. I'm sure he heard about him. He probably saw him. He probably heard him prophesy on several occasions and saw him and knew very well about him. They may have even been friends. We don't know. Of course, Ezekiel undoubtedly was a younger contemporary of Jeremiah's. So Jeremiah had been ministering for 30 years when Ezekiel was carried to Babylon. Now, Ezekiel does not mention Jeremiah in his book, but that doesn't mean anything. Most of the prophets don't mention most of the other prophets in their books. There's a few exceptions to that. Jeremiah mentions the prophet Micah, or somebody in his book mentions the prophet Micah. Ezekiel mentions the prophet Daniel. Daniel mentions the prophet Jeremiah. So there are some references back and forth, but basically, you know, they were called to be talking about everybody else, other men that were ministering, even that they were, though some of them were contemporaries. They had a message from God and they gave it. And they aren't basically historical books. They're prophetical books. Books filled with messages foretelling the future. Now, Daniel, as we've already indicated on the board, had gone into captivity as a youth in 605 B.C. Now, that means that Daniel undoubtedly saw Jeremiah's ministry, because Jeremiah had been ministering for 22 years, approximately, before Daniel went into captivity. So he got to see the weeping prophet's ministry. So Daniel goes into captivity some 8 years before Ezekiel does. Daniel, as I've said, was selected to serve in the court of the king of Babylon himself, Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, God anointed Daniel and gave him the ability to interpret the dreams that God was giving Nebuchadnezzar, just like Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dreams in Egypt of old, and gave him wisdom and so forth. And so he was given a very high position in the Babylonian government. Now, Ezekiel, as I said, does mention the prophet Daniel in his book. That's just a kind of a passing reference almost, but he does mention him. Now, Daniel was in the city of Babylon, in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. Ezekiel was 40 miles to the east, and that's a long walk. It's not like they're going to be, you know, seeing each other all the time, if indeed they ever saw each other once they were in exile. So Ezekiel was out in the country with the captives. Daniel was in the city. They may have visited each other. They may have tried to keep up on one another as much as they could. I don't know. But as I've said, Daniel ministered through the entire 70-year captivity and even on into the Persian period. Daniel, being in a high governmental position in Babylon, was in a position, if he was allowed to at all, to help the captives through legislation or preventing certain legislation, if nothing else. And I'm sure the man of God that he was, praying all the time and praying for God to restore the people back to Judah, as he does in that eloquent prayer in Daniel chapter 9, I'm sure he did everything that was within his power to make sure that the Jews were treated, you know, kindly and tolerantly and humanely and so forth, and whatever he could do. Ezekiel doesn't seem to have had any authority, civil authority or power or office. He was just among the other captives there in Babylon. Now, as I've indicated already, nothing is known of the end of Ezekiel's ministry or the end of his life. So it's a question mark. We don't know what happened. Now, the book itself. There's a number of different ways that you can divide the book as far as outlining it goes. And I'm going to be giving you simple outlines. I'm going to give you a two-part, a three-part, and a four-part outline. Kind of take your pick. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to abbreviate a lot. One, divides it into two sections. Chapters 1 to 24 and chapters 25 to 48. Chapters 1 to 24, I'll just describe to you, depicts the moral condition of Judah during the reigns of Jehoiakim, C-H-I-N, and Zedekiah. Ezekiel depicts the moral condition of Judah. Now by that, I mean Judah that is still in Judah, that is still in the land, during the reigns of Jehoiakim and Zedekiah. Then chapters 25 to 48 can be generalized as being promises and consolations. Promises and consolations. Of course, it's a very simplified outline. Now here's the three part. 1 to 24 is part 1. 25 to 32 is part 2. And 33 to 48 is part 3. All right, part 1 or chapters 1 to 24, he announces the approaching fall of Jerusalem. So God does reveal to the man that it won't be too long, the city will fall. As we're going to see, that was contrary to the popular opinion, at least the popular wishes and fantasies of the people. In fact, they were being taught and hoping that not only would Judah not fall, but those that had already been taken captive would very shortly go back to the land and everything would be just business as usual. And he was letting them know that it was not going to be that way. The city was going to fall, and the rest of them were going to come, the ones that didn't die in the siege, into captivity. 25 to 32 can be summarized as prophecies against the Gentile nations. Prophecies against the Gentiles. And then 33 to 48 is prophecies of Israel's future restoration. Prophecies of Israel's future restoration. And then the four-parter is 1 to 24, part 1, 25 to 32, part 2, 33 to 39 is part 3, and 40 to 48 is part 4. Part 1 is he's exhorting the Jews to repent before the fall of Jerusalem. He exhorts them to repent before the fall of Jerusalem. Of course, by comparing these outlines, you can learn more about each section by seeing the different ways that we're looking at them. 25 to 32 are prophecies against seven nations which surrounded Israel. Prophecies against seven surrounding nations. 33 to 39, hope you're abbreviating to save yourself some time, is Israel's spiritual condition and promises of future blessing. He depicts Israel's spiritual condition and promises of future blessing. And then 40 to 48 is the millennial conditions and glory. Millennial conditions and glory. Now, the book of Ezekiel uses probably more symbols and more allegories than any other Old Testament prophet. For example, he compares Jerusalem in one place to a worthless vine. You've got this grape arbor and you've got a vine and it just does not produce grapes. And another time he compares it to a faithless wife. She's gone out and played the harlot against her husband, broken her covenant. On another occasion, he compares it to the northern kingdom with its capital at Samaria, which of course had already gone into captivity under the Assyrians over a century before. And he says that Judah is a sister to this northern kingdom, so he calls them sisters. The house of David, or the remaining kingdom there of Judah, on one occasion he calls a lion's den, you know, filled with violence and so forth. Another time he calls them a vine. Another time he compares them to the lofty cedars of Lebanon. So he uses an awful lot of symbols and allegories to bring forth the truth. And his priestly background kind of shows through in various places, just like Luke's physician's background kind of shows through in Luke in the book of Acts a few places. And so his knowledge and understanding of the temple and holiness and the laws of God and the Deuteronomic and Levitical codes and so forth kind of show through in certain segments where the Lord is speaking through him and writing through him. Now, as the catalog description indicated, he has several of these symbolic acts that he performs that are prophetic, laying siege to his own house, laying on his side, various other things. And these are rather strange things because they don't really have a counterpart in our culture and in our day. And I don't know if they ever will. But they meant something to the people that had an eye to see and an ear to hear and a mind to interpret and understand, a heart that was open mostly. But he did these things because it was another way of communicating to the people what God was about to do. And, of course, he received also many, many visions from God. Now, Ezekiel carefully dates many of his prophecies, which is to our benefit in that it does allow us to place many of them in chronological order. And looking at these dated prophecies, the undated you have to look at internal evidence, and then you just speculate as to when they may or may not have come, and you can't be sure. But looking at the prophecies, his ministry seems to fall into two broad periods. The period from 593 to 586, and of course 586 is that key date again, that's the fall of Jerusalem. And you could generalize and say that primarily he was preaching and proclaiming judgment against Judah during that period. 593 to 586, judgment against Judah. And then the second period ending from 586 to whenever his ministry ended. Remember, 570 could be, or we're going by the date 560, we're assuming one another 10 years. During this period, the Lord, through the prophet, offered a lot of consolation. And that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, what other judgment can you do? The nation's been destroyed, and then there's just survivors now in exile. So now the Lord comes in, and he brings consolation. And he foretells of that wonderful era of restoration for Israel that lays ahead in the distant future. Taylor, in his commentary, lists some 14 of the prophecies of Ezekiel in chronological order. So that would mean that there are at least 14 of them that are dated in the book itself and that can be put in an order. Now, as far as the Hebrew text of the book of Ezekiel goes, and this will close my introduction, for some reason or another, the book of Ezekiel has more errors in transmission than most of the other Old Testament books. In other words, copyist errors. Now, even at that, you're still not looking at anywhere near the errors that you have in the New Testament manuscripts, because the Jews were so careful in recopying their manuscripts, as one would become unusable. But still, it has more than most in the Old Testament. Also, and so that becomes a difficulty to the exegete, because then you have to try to figure out what the right reading is and so forth. Also, it has a number of rare words, and those can be difficult in assigning a meaning, because if it's rare, then you don't have a whole lot of places that you can go and see that word in action, as it were, or used in order to find out what it means. Also, there are various technical expressions found in the book. For example, in the descriptions of the temple in chapters 40 to 48, there are architectural terms, technical architectural terms that are used. And I think that may be what some of these things may be what have led some of the copyists into errors. Terms that were so rare that they didn't know the meaning of it anymore, or that it was easy to copy it wrong, and architectural terms that had become obscure as to their meaning and so forth, and could be the cause of the large, relatively large number of copyist errors in the book. However, I take the course that our pastor does in being reluctant to opt for a reading of any of the versions or ancient translations of the Hebrew over the Masoretic text or received Hebrew text. Even if the Hebrew is obscure, that does not necessarily in and of itself mean that it's a copyist error. It may be obscure because we just don't know the meaning of that particular word anymore, but it may be the very word that God inspired to be there. So you have to look at an awful lot of things besides just that one factor before you determine that it's a copyist error. And then once you've determined that, you've got to look at alternate readings in the other manuscripts, Hebrew manuscripts, and then you have to come up with them. And you can take into consideration the versions, especially if you've got all the versions lining up, including the Septuagint on one side and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are of help. And then the Hebrew seems totally, you know, nonsensical. And maybe there's even some variation among the Hebrew manuscripts. Then you might have a basis for taking the reading of the versions, and maybe if they accord with one of the lesser attested Hebrew manuscript readings or something like that, and using that for your textual reading. Two fragments of the Hebrew text of Ezekiel have been found with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they are a brief section, only chapter 4, verse 16, through chapter 5, verse 1. And they, like most of the rest of the scriptural portions of the Dead Sea Scrolls, are found to be very close in general with the Masoretic text, which is very important because it shows us how careful the Hebrews had been in copying them, because the Masoretic text dates A.D., after Christ, from about 800 to 1000. The Dead Sea Scrolls date from about B.C. 200 B.C. to about 200 A.D., somewhere in that range. So they may go back as far as 1,000 years before any of our earliest extant Masoretic manuscripts. And yet when we find them to be so much in accord in almost all places with the Masoretic text, it lets us know that's how careful they had been over a 1,000-year period with their transmitting the text. And it gives us confidence then in the Hebrew manuscripts. All right, chapter 1. Any questions on the intro before we move along? All right. Now, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. So Ezekiel is speaking of himself in the first person, isn't he? I saw this, and this happened to me. Notice that he starts with the word now. That is actually a conjunction in the Hebrew, and it could very well be translated and. In fact, Rotherham does translate it and. And it came to pass in the 30th year. However, whenever you start a sentence with a conjunction, and, but, and so forth, it obviously implies that there is something that has gone before that, that you are conjoining what you're saying now with. It's a conjunction, to join with. Nobody would ever start out talking to say, and what I want to say is, and what? Obviously he must have said something before that, and now he's adding to it. Well, to start off a book with the word and seems rather strange, because here's the book, and you open it up and you read it and it says and. Obviously he must be joining it with something that went before. By the way, the prophet Jonah starts out this way as well. In Jonah 1:1, it starts out with a conjunction. Well, what could it be joined to? Well, first of all, I know that it's not joined to any missing portions of the book of Ezekiel, so we can throw out that, you know, lost books of the Bible mentality. But in the English Bible, in the order in which we see the books in our King James Version, it's preceded by Jeremiah's book of Lamentations. And so we might wonder, well, is it joined to Lamentations? Well, possibility, because what was Jeremiah lamenting? The fall of Jerusalem. And what is Ezekiel going to be prophesying of? The fall of Jerusalem. So there's a possibility there. However, in the Hebrew Bible, in their Bible, Ezekiel is preceded by the book of Jeremiah itself, without having Lamentations in between the two. Lamentations is in another place in their Bible. And so, possibly, he's connecting it with the book of Jeremiah, showing that God intended a person to understand Jeremiah. Maybe we should make that a prerequisite for Ezekiel class, right? To understand. How many have taken Jeremiah? Just out of curiosity. Well, look at that. How about that? Almost everybody, to the man. To have read and understood Jeremiah's prophecies before they read Ezekiel's, because both were prophets to Judah. They were contemporaries. They're much similar in their subject matter and the points that they're getting across. And so, Jeremiah ministers, and I was, so on and so forth. Here Ezekiel steps forward, and he gives the world his testimony of what happened in his day. Possibility. Maybe he's joining it with unwritten history, that which was before his mind as he, under divine inspiration, wrote his book. It's not real clear. And it came to pass in the 30th year. You know, we know enough about the Bible, that statement in Isaiah about precept upon precept, line upon line, that we know that ultimately God expects a person to get into the whole Word, all 66 books of the Bible. Now, some more important than others in terms of, you know, ultimate theology and so forth. You don't have to major on the book of 2 John to make it into heaven. You know, there are points in the book. It belongs there. It's part of the canon. But I'd take the book of Romans any day over the book of 2 John. If I was going to only have one Bible book to take with me on a desert island, you know, it wouldn't be Philemon. You know, it wouldn't. And nothing against Paul's epistle to Philemon. It's a beautiful little story, and it's got some wonderful truths in it. But I'd take Romans, or I'd take, you know, the Gospel of John, or I'd take something meaty, you know, that's got more in it. But God expects us to know something about all of it, and a lot more about some of it. So he takes the liberty to throw conjunctions in every so often just to let us know, you know. You take the whole package, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help you, God. Now, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as he was among the captives. Have you noticed that he didn't say the 30th year of what? He says in the 30th year. 30th year of what? He doesn't even tell you. The subject is not given in the verse. It's not stated. And so it's left up to us to guess what 30th year he's referring to, that he was in captivity, that the heavens were opened. And I'm going to give you the four possibilities that have been offered among the learned men of old who have studied this book. Number one, it could refer to the 30th year of the man's life. He could be saying, when I was 30 years old, well, another way to say it is, in the 30th year, that is, of my life, in the fourth month of the 30th year, in the fifth day of the month. So in the 30th year of his life, and he was he's a priest and a prophet. Now, granted, it would be rather unusual to put it this way. Usually a person would say, when I was 30 years of age, or when I was 25, or whatever. Is that our last bell? Time flies. To me, anyway. Now, maybe it's dragging to you down there. I hope not, but I wanted to get farther than this. I mean, we're not behind or anything, but the bell always seems to come too soon to me, I guess, is what that boils down to. But anyway, if you can wait with bated breath till a week from today, we're going to give you the four possibilities for this 30th year here of this captivity. So we'll see you next week.